Hello, as the Philadelphia Orchestra sets out on a tour of the United States, we speak with music director Christoph Eschenbach. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Independent Seaport Museum at Penn's Landing in Philadelphia. The Waterfront Museum features a working boat shop, an 1892 battleship used in the Spanish-American War, and a World War II submarine. Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia music director Ignaz Solzhenitsyn tells us about the group's season-ending Old Brahms presentation, and Susan Lewis takes a look at William H. Johnson's World on Paper, the latest exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra began its 2007 United States tour earlier this week. The three-week-long trip includes 12 concerts in 11 cities throughout the Midwest and on both coasts. The orchestra kicked off the tour in Kansas City, Missouri on Tuesday, played in Chicago on Wednesday, Omaha, Nebraska on Thursday, before traveling to California, where they'll perform in Davis this evening, the first of six concerts in the Golden State. I spoke with Philadelphia Orchestra music director Christoph Eschenbach prior to departure and first asked him about how he programs an orchestra tour.
It's a variety of music and not necessarily always music which is played all the time. For example, the Schoenberg Chamber Symphony, the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante for Winds and Orchestra, and then as war horses of the symphonic repertoire.
I've never heard you use that word before.
Well, or battle ships or whatever. It's a symphony fantastique, mm-hmm. Berlioz, a favorite of mine, and the Brahms number one, also a favorite of mine.
And are you getting a different performance out of the musicians with these war horses on tour? Because there are things that all of you have played hundreds of times. Does the fact that it's a new audience, it's an audience who probably perhaps hasn't heard this music as often, does that somehow make the way it's performed different?
Look, we perform every night somehow different because we are different every night. And plus the venue, plus the new audience, and that particular audience which you speak of, inspires makes us play and sense the piece which we play in a new way. And so the bottom line is to go to great cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, but also to smaller places, that we are very inspired by the mix also of these two issues and two aspects of performing.
You've been somebody who's been extraordinarily well-traveled, both as a music director of various orchestras as well as the Philadelphia Orchestra, and from your previous life as a concert pianist. Do you have some routines? Are there certain things you always do on tour? Do you read on airplanes? Do you have certain things that are not part of your daily life when you're not on tour?
You just said a word which I really hate, is routine. And therefore, the answer is I don't have routine.
Good.
on my tour life.
So is it more of the same? Is it still work, or is this sort of a semi-vacation to go and see these places, or is it just solid work?
No, it's really solid work, because you are, as a conductor, representing the orchestra, and you are responsible for the situation in which the orchestra arrives in these places, be it a bit tired or be it whatever. You are responsible for them and for the music making, and that is really, really very professional and a thing which occupies your mind all the time on tour, though it's not a sightseeing trip.
And then the idea as well of playing in halls that you perhaps haven't performed in before. Do you have a way of trying to get an understanding of the acoustic of a room before the orchestra shows up, or do you learn there with the musicians what the room sounds like?
Well, I'm always there early enough before to whistle a bit and mm-hmm. make some snap with a finger in those halls. And
and that's enough, sorry, but you're getting an understanding of it.
I have really much experience, I must say. And I sense a hall right away. And with musicians come in and warm up a little and warm up for the concerts, then I get more inside. And then by the beginning of the concert, I have a rather good idea how the hall will sound.
An excerpt from a January performance of Schoenberg's Chamber Symphony No. 1, the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by music director Christoph Eschenbach, recorded live in Verizon Hall at the Kimmel Center. The orchestra continues its 2007 U.S. tour this evening with a concert in Davis, California. It performs in San Francisco tomorrow evening and makes its debut at Walt Disney Hall in Los Angeles on Tuesday. The tour concludes on June 3rd at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia is today a major hub for commercial, educational, and cultural activity, and this has long been the case. But what has made Philadelphia into such a vibrant urban center? History suggests its proximity to the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers, and in turn the Atlantic Ocean, played no small part in the city's development. The Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia explores the rich maritime legacy of this region and takes a look at the ruggedness of life on the sea from a variety of perspectives. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer takes us there.
The Seaport Museum was originally founded in 1960 as the Philadelphia Maritime Museum by the late J. Wells Henderson, a Philadelphia attorney from the city's Germantown section. Inspired by his summer jobs during college as a longshoreman on Philadelphia's waterfront, Henderson saw a need for a public institution that represented the maritime history of the Delaware Valley. Unlike many cities in the Northeast, Philadelphia had no museum to honor its maritime past, so Henderson decided to create one himself. With a collection of artifacts, books, and paintings, the museum had three different homes at various locations during its first 35 years. In 1995, the museum moved into the refurbished Port of History building at Penn's Landing, and the Philadelphia Maritime Museum was renamed the Independent Seaport Museum. Craig Bruns is curator of the museum. He says that Philadelphia's geographical location and the fact that it's a freshwater port has both benefits and drawbacks.
Philadelphia is located 100 miles inland, which is a good thing. That means that goods, instead of just going to the shore, are actually unloaded 100 miles inland, 100 miles more inland than New York is, or any of the other ports. But also, it's 100 miles away from sea, which makes it a bad thing. Because it's a river, it freezes. And that has been very difficult for commerce in the past. During the winter months, the port was closed. The other ports were not closed. But it was a safe harbor, being 100 miles in, away from the storms that would plague the ocean and damage the ships.
Run says that in early America, before the railroads, waterways were the highways. Roads were not built very well and rather dangerous, so rivers like the Schuylkill and the Delaware were essential for transporting goods.
Eventually, New York took over, primarily with the development of canals. But early on in American history, Philadelphia was the center of the East Coast.
Philadelphia's history as a major port for trade and commerce is just one of the topics explored in the exhibits of the Independence Seaport Museum, which is located just off the Delaware River near Philadelphia's Old City. The permanent displays include a look at the science of boating, the history of Philadelphia as a port for immigration and a home for the shipbuilding industry, an exploration of undersea technology through the ages, and a collection of boats indigenous to the Delaware River Valley. Craig Brunn says that one prized possession of the museum is a decorative wooden carving of a full-length female figure from the prow of a 19th century ship, created by Philadelphia sculptor William Rush.
This figurehead is one of a very few that exist of his work. He's more known now for his sculpture at the Art Museum and various places around town, but really, most of his output were ship figureheads. But all of those, as ships themselves, have disappeared. So we're lucky to have this one.
The Seaport Museum is not limited to exhibits, however. It also runs a working boat shop dedicated to the skills and traditions of wooden boat building and sailing. John Brady is the boat shop manager.
We specialize in boats from the Delaware Valley and the New Jersey shore, but we're not limited to them. Most of the work is by volunteers. We do a lot of that. I'd say we see 2,500 to 3,000 volunteer hours in here a year. Anyone who wants to can come down and learn how, if they can put up with me and deal with a day of sandpaper.
Brady has been with the boat shop since it opened in 1995, repairing and restoring wooden watercraft like old summer camp rowboats, workboats for oystering, and racing boats. Brady explains while many kinds of vessels pass through the shop, some old, some more modern, the skills needed to work with wooden boats haven't changed much.
The tools that you see in here are all electrically powered, but the main difference between our tools and the tools of, say, 1890 are that. They would have been steam-powered. Ours are electrically driven, but they had all the same stuff. And so the techniques that we're using are very much the same as they were then.
Of course, many boats are not made of wood, and the museum celebrates that dimension of maritime history as well. Visitors can climb aboard the USS Olympia, a 344-foot-long steel warship anchored in the Delaware River by the museum. Built during a time of peace, the 1892 cruiser was Admiral Dewey's flagship during the Battle of Manila Bay in the Spanish-American War. Decommissioned in 1922, today it's the oldest steel warship afloat in the world. The steam-powered vessel was sophisticated for its day. It features two luxurious cabins for the admiral and the ship's captain, and it was designed to accommodate about 400 men, essentially making it a floating city, complete with a machine shop, a ship store, a laundry facility, and even a dentist's chair. Standing in the engine room of the warship, historic ship's manager, Jesse Lebovics, explains how the Navy men communicated as they operated this large vessel.
Radios, telephones, all like that didn't exist at the time of this boat. There were some very primitive telephone rings. It was speaking tubes, and then everything else was bells. So there were various complex systems to describe what a bell was telling you, and there were different size bells that made different noises, and that was the emergency backup.
Floating alongside the USS Olympia is a World War II submarine, the Bakuna. It completed 5 wartime patrols in the Pacific Ocean and is similar to the many submarines built by the U.S. Navy in Philadelphia.
The dive alarm right here. It's called a Claxton. They don't use that sound anymore. 3 times, and then you say dive, 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 down you go, and then you do it again.
Launched in 1944, Jesse Lebovics says the Bakuna was built during World War II to win World War II.
That was her function. So she's very stripped down. It's just the bare minimum, nothing extra. The boys say with great pride that this boat actually had an ice cream machine on it, which put it well above a lot of the other submarines out there. But it was a hardship. What I find astounding is all of our old veterans still remembered as some of the finest times of their lives, even though it was clearly pretty hard.
Living and working on the water has always been both compelling and difficult, from Navy life to the journey of immigrants to the tough work of professional seafarers. The Independent Seaport Museum celebrates the role of water in our history, the people who have called it home, and those who carry its traditions forward.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The founder of the Independent Seaport Museum, J. Wells Henderson, died at the age of 86 earlier this month. To honor Mr. Henderson's memory, the museum and its historic ships will have free entry to everyone this weekend. The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia completes its 06-07 season tomorrow afternoon and on Monday evening with a challenging all Brahms program featuring the Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia Chamber Chorus. It's the third full season for the orchestra with Ignat Solzhenitsyn as music director. I spoke with Maestro Solzhenitsyn earlier this week backstage at the Kimmel Center and first asked if 3 years in, he felt audiences were now fully in tune with his programming philosophy.
Well, I hope so. I guess I don't know that, but based on our very, very encouraging subscription rates, and since we've announced the season, the subscriptions are renewing very, very, you know, higher and faster than before. So based on that, I guess the answer is yes.
So let's talk then about next season. Are there any experiments in the way that you approach
that? Yes, there are. There are a couple of programs that certainly don't look safe on the page. And there are a couple of all 20th century programs. There's a program which has only 20th century brass music in the first half and then 20th century string music in the second half. Xenakis and two pieces of Berg and Henri Thomassy, Gross. So people that are not necessarily household names, but I thought it would be very interesting to do to feature our brass section and to feature our woodwinds in another concert, and to really have at least a half a program in each case dedicated just to those groups.
Is there any danger, because with a lot of this more edgy material, you're going to attract perhaps a younger, hipper audience? Are you then programming that at the risk of perhaps alienating the traditional audience?
The first thing you learn in any position of leadership is that you cannot make everyone happy. Clearly, any piece that I could program, including what do you think is safe, a Mozart or a Beethoven or a Bach symphony or an oratorio or overture, is going to not please somebody, because somebody will say, this year has been too much Bach, or I'm tired of the Sixth Symphony of Beethoven. Why didn't they program the third or the second? I'm tired of this. Somebody's always going to be unhappy, and somebody will be happy. So I don't worry about that too much. I worry that the programs have integrity in and of itself, and that it's a program. I use a pretty simple criterion for this. Is it a program I would want to hear? And, of course, you could say, well, the program you would want to hear is not the same. But I think people listen to music in much the same way. And I don't want to hear a bizarre, really out-of-the-way program, you know, any more than anybody else does. I want a program that makes sense. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily music I know or even composers I know, but I want it to make sense and to have a structure and to have a satisfying sort of beginning and end, or from beginning to end for it to make sense. And,
but that said, you're still going to have to program things that you've heard and played many more times than typically the audience would have done.
Well, but that's sort of the public service that we provide, if you will, and that's why we're there. But all of that has to be in good balance, so that while not everybody will be happy all the time, most everyone will be happy most of the time. That's a more realistic goal to keep in mind.
Tell me about the challenges of programming all Brahms.
The challenge of programming any one composer in a program is that it leaves less margin for error. And it makes, of course, a statement about that composer, and it invites the audience to participate in a more in-depth survey of the music than a more eclectic program. And so the challenge is, briefly summed up, you better have something valid and interesting to say.
In this instance, you're in a room that is the envy of many chamber orchestras around the world. Are you pushing the limits of it now by bringing in this 25 or 30-piece choir in addition to having the orchestra here?
I don't think so, because, you know, those we'll find out soon enough. But we've worked with chorus here, but on the big side of the stage, not on this small side of the stage. I don't think so, because both of these pieces are lightly orchestrated, the Begräbnisgesang in particular, and the textures are very transparent. So as a matter of fact, my concern going in before we've combined the chorus and the orchestra is to make sure that the chorus can be heard above the orchestra. So that's the only challenge that I'm anticipating in terms of balances in this room.
Is the Brahms being programmed now at the end of the season? Is there any particular reason to? Is this a nice way of signing out the season? Or what was you thinking way back a year ago when you were putting this season together?
Yes, I do think that ending the season on this festive note, even though we have a burial hymn. But in any case, festive because it involves the chorus and because the sort of the sights and sounds of these pieces are so magnificent. And then the extraordinary First Serenade, which is really Symphony Number Zero, if you will, you know, his first experiment in large scale orchestral form. It's a glorious, glorious way to go out, and I do think it will be a very satisfying season ender for us and for our audience.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Jim, as always.
Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia Music Director Ignat Solzhenitsyn. The orchestra completes its 06-07 season tomorrow afternoon and on Monday evening at the Perelman Theatre at the Kimmel Center with an all Brahms program featuring the Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia Chamber Chorus. Oscar and Grammy-winning composer, arranger, conductor, and pianist Michel Legrand is the special guest at the orchestra's annual gala this evening at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Philadelphia. A new show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, opening today, exhibits the varied work of a prolific early 20th century American artist whose career was cut short by mental illness. Best known for his colorful geometric paintings depicting African-American life, William H. Johnson spent the first half of his short career in Europe, where he experimented with a variety of artistic trends. This exhibition of 80 works tracks Johnson's artistic journey, from paintings that recall the European Impressionists to German-style block prints to African folk art and American modernism. Drawn largely from the collection of the Smithsonian Institution, the Philadelphia show also includes oils and prints from local private collections and museum holdings. WRTI's Susan Lewis spent some time at the exhibition earlier this week.
The journey of one artist through many subjects and in many media and styles. This is William H. Johnson's World on Paper, an exhibition of 80 of his works from the first half of the 20th century, with a range so varied you might think you were looking at the work of more than one person. On one wall are large sunflowers painted in oil, their yellow petals rich and textured with broad brushstrokes. Pivot and see a wall of portraits made with hand-colored block prints. Round a bend are bright impressionist watercolors, pen and ink, more block prints, and silkscreen prints on paper in a kind of geometric jigsaw style. The subjects are as varied as the styles. Images of a mosque in North Africa, a sunset in Norway, farmland from America's South, and life on the streets of Harlem. Museum director Ann Darnincourt says that Johnson's range is all the more impressive, considering that mental illness stopped him from working in his 40s.
What is extraordinary is how much he accomplished in the short span of time that he had.
Choosing to be an artist is a risky career move for anyone at any time. It was especially so for an African-American man born in 1901 and raised in rural South Carolina. William Johnson loved to copy comic books when he was a child, a talent that would resurface in his later years. But by the age of 17, he recognized the obstacles he would face in the South, says John Itman, curator of prints at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
He made his way to New York, where his uncle and aunt lived in Harlem and had odd jobs and started out probably in night school at the National Academy and then immediately started winning prizes. He was singled out as a really promising artist.
After graduating in 1926, Johnson went to Paris. There, he joined a community of European and expatriate American artists. Writers like Ernest Hemingway, the legendary jazz singer Josephine Baker, Philadelphia-born painter Henry Tanner, as well as Edvard Munch and Vincent van Gogh. Over the next decade, the young artist feasted on a smorgasbord of styles.
He ran into Chaim Soutine, who was an Eastern European artist who settled in Paris, who had a very expressionist style. His wife's brother-in-law was a German sculptor who had trained in Dresden, which was one of the centers for German expressionism, and where woodcut was widely practiced. And he may have taught, or at least interested, Johnson in making woodcuts. And his rough-cut woodcuts have all of that force of expression that the German artists have at the same period.
Although Johnson came back to the States in 1929 and was awarded the William E. Harmon Foundation's Gold Medal for Distinguished Achievement Among Negroes, because of racial tensions, he quickly returned to Europe. In 1930, he married Danish textile artist Holke Krake, with whom he traveled through Europe and North Africa. Everywhere he went, he soaked up the culture, picking up techniques and making them his own.
William H. Johnson is inspired by other artists' work, just as Matisse was inspired by the art of the past, and so was Cézanne. But he's never derivative. They look very much like his own view of the world.
By 1938, America looked like a safer haven than Nazi-occupied Europe, particularly for an interracial couple. So they moved to New York, but making a living was difficult. Johnson finally got a job teaching art at a community center. Meanwhile, says John Ittman, his art entered a new phase.
When he comes back to New York, he has a new goal and a new challenge for himself, and he develops a new style that is uniquely his.
Johnson's new goal, his impassioned mission, was to represent the African-American experience, from the rural Southerners to city schoolchildren, from churchgoers and soldiers to people on the streets and in the nightclubs of New York, where Jitterbug was all the rage.
And he makes these wonderful screen prints and tempera paintings of the dancers using this new style, blocks of color, capturing the syncopated rhythms of the beat of the music and the wonderful dancers bouncing up and down and just full of joy and rhythm.
In his series he called Fighters for Freedom, he painted figures from history, like abolitionist John Brown and Abraham Lincoln, who are portrayed in this show, to Marian Anderson and Eleanor Roosevelt, who are not. As his subjects became more focused, his style was also changing. He brought together all he had learned from his comic book days through his European sojourn, incorporating elements of European Impressionism, African folk art, German woodcutting, and designs from quilting traditions.
He starts making his pictures out of elements from geometry, circles, squares, triangles. There are trees that look like lollipops or popsicles. A cloud is a stripe across the sky, and sometimes it's blue, sometimes it's red, sometimes it's purple, but it's still a cloud. Once you see his work, you recognize it anywhere.
Suddenly, in midlife and mid-career, tragedy struck Johnson. In late 1943, his wife was diagnosed with cancer and died only several months later. By 1946, Johnson's own physical and mental health had severely declined, and he spent the last 23 years of his life in an institution. He died in obscurity in 1970. Much of Johnson's artwork was safeguarded by the Harmon Foundation, which transferred over 1,000 works to the Smithsonian in 1967. But his art was somewhat neglected by the art establishment for a time.
It happens to many artists who sort of disappear from the scene in the mid-20th century. They have to almost be rediscovered.
This exhibition is a rediscovery of the breadth and depth of this versatile artist, from the broad, bright brushstrokes of color in his impressionistic paintings to his colored block prints and geometric silk screens. Arranged both chronologically and thematically, the pictures take visitors on a personal journey of William H. Johnson. They show the development of this artist who traveled extensively, then came home to graphically depict his America through the eyes of a citizen of the world.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. William H. Johnson's World on Paper opens today at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and runs through August 12th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Catherine Blodgett, Catherine Brown, Laurie Zaromsky, Rich Duran, Norman Keyes, and Elizabeth Flynn. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.